Today on The Grave Talks, Dissecting the Dead, a conversation with Elliot Van Dusen. Since childhood, Elliot Van Dusen has been fascinated by the supernatural and law enforcement. He earned a Bachelor's of Arts in Criminology from St. Mary's University. Having served the Royal Canadian Mounted Police for 15 years, he retired as a corporal. Over the course of his career, he specialized in major crimes, including homicide, sex crimes, and drug enforcement. Today, he serves as the director of the Paranormal Phenomena Research and Investigation Team. We learn about his research and experiences with the paranormal on The Grave Talks.
For me, looking back at things, the first memory I have of being interested in the paranormal was the television show Unsolved Mysteries. And it was two reasons for that. One, I always wanted to be a police officer, so I found the homicide cold cases that Unsolved Mysteries would show very interesting. But then every once in a while, they'd talk about a ghost file or a UFO file or even a cryptid file. And that, too, also fascinated me. And so I watched that show religiously. And then I think in about 1997, I discovered the X-Files TV show. And that had come out in 1993, but I didn't find out about it until 97. And I thought it was really cool. It had two law enforcement officers investigating the paranormal. So I decided to start my own kind of research organization to look into anything paranormal and unexplained. And then we moved to Halifax, Nova Scotia from Sydney, Nova Scotia, which is about 5 hours away, back in 1998. And my mother had come to me with a newspaper article talking about a gentleman at the Nova Scotia Community College that was teaching parapsychology. So I went on their website and saw that they offered two different courses and signed up for them both. And the instructor would later become my mentor in parapsychology, and it's Dr. Daryl Walsh, who's also part of my organization that I still run today, which is called Paranormal Phenomena Research and Investigation. Mm-hmm. And once I completed those two courses, of course, my interest in the subject never really waned, so I continued to seek out other sort of educational opportunities that were available at the time. And at the time, there wasn't really much available for parapsychology education, but I ended up taking a diploma program through the Stratford Career Institute out of Toronto, Ontario. And then, of course, I went to St. Mary's University, where I studied criminology, which is a mix basically of sociology and psychology. Mm-hmm. Then I got recruited by the RCMP. So I kind of did the opposite of what Fox Mulder did, where he went from kind of behavioral sciences to the paranormal, whereas I had gone from the paranormal into the RCMP doing law enforcement. And I did 15 years. I just retired May 2020. And I spent 8 of those 15 years doing major crimes, behavioral science, homicide type work. But I also continue to kind of do the paranormal from the side of my desk, I guess. Mm-hmm. I tried to take a few more courses, and eventually I took a degree program while I was a police officer. And I learned very quickly you don't talk about the paranormal in law enforcement. At least that was my experience. I have talked to a few police officers that have had the opposite experience, but much like Fox Mulder did in the television show, I received a lot of ridicule for being interested in the subject. So I pursued it quietly. And then about a couple years before I retired, I knew I was getting ready to probably medical out of the Royal Canadian Mounted Police. And I started to do the odd podcast here and there. And then I had a huge file I worked on in Rhode Island, haunting. And I wrote a book on it and started to come back out. And out of the closet, so to speak. And then mm-hmm. once I was back out there and I retired from the RCMP, now this is pretty much all that I do, because I'm on pension and I have the fortunate opportunity to just kind of work at this at my own time and at my own leisure and do as much of it that I want now.
Sure. When you were in the Mounted Police before you retired, what sort of experience, did you have any experiences in that capacity as essentially a police officer?
Not as a police officer. Before I joined the RCMP, we had my organization had investigated a haunted house in Kentville, Nova Scotia. Mm-hmm. It was built in the 1800s, and a couple had just bought it and moved in. They had only lived there for about 6 months. And they had reported a few different things, which is what piqued my curiosity. So one, they said that they would see an apparition of a female walk down the main stairwell. It's kind of like a split entry home. They had a dog pass away, and they started seeing the spirit of the dog in the house, especially in their bedroom. They thought they were seeing faces in photographs, which I'll get to in a minute. And they also had pennies that were materializing in the house on their own. So there's a lot of activity going on. So I was certainly interested. So I put together a team of about five of us, and we went down, and of course we get there and we scan the house and it's clean. And they showed us the jar where they collect all the pennies, but I mean, it wasn't anything impressive. You know, it just looked like a change jar that someone was saving up, up their change with. But we checked, you know, the kitchen and the living room in the house, and there was no pennies laying around, no loose change. Mm-hmm. And as the evening would go on, we would take our base readings with the electromagnetic field radiation detector, which is used to, you know, check the wiring in the house and make sure that there's no unshielded wires or dangerous levels of radiation leaking out of them. And by the stairwell where they used to see the female apparition come down, we were getting quite a high reading there. And it was pretty consistent. And then around 3 a.m, I had an investigator that was checking the camera in the kitchen dining room area about once every hour, just to make sure the tape was still good and batteries were still good. And sure enough, at 3 a.m, around there, he had found a penny at the base of the tripod that had appeared. And where the camera was situated at, there was only one way in, one way out. And the entire investigative team was sitting in the living room, which was the only way in and out. And so nobody else in the household had, you know, come in through there. None of my investigators had gone in through there except for the guy that was checking the equipment. And you could hear everything on the audio. So, you know, you could kind of hear our conversation in the background. And then when he would go check the equipment, you could hear his footsteps really clearly on the tape. Mm-hmm. But at no time do you hear any metal hit the floor or anyone shuffling around or anything like that. And of course, right where the penny was at the base of the tripod was outside of the camera lenses view. So you don't actually see anything on there. And that's kind of all that happened that night, which was, you know, really interesting. So we got these high EMF readings, and we have a penny that, you know, appeared that we couldn't explain. So we asked if we could come back a second night, and she said, sure. And so we came back a second night. I brought a bigger team this time, about 10 of us. So we had most of the team inside, and we had two guys outside with night vision on the house as well. So when we were in the house, again, we started getting those high EMF readings near the stairwell. So one of my investigators had the idea to turn off the power to the house. So we asked the homeowners if we could just kind of go down to the breaker box and turn off the master power switch, and they were okay with that. And once that was done, the EMF readings near the stairwell stopped. So he turned the power back on, and of course the EMF readings started up again. Mm-hmm. So he asked me to kind of stomp my foot where I was standing. So I did that, and he kind of followed the noise and the wiring and the electrical underneath the main floor. And he found basically unshielded wires because the home was built in the 1800s. So that kind of explained why we were getting that constant, consistent high EMF reading. So we let the homeowners know, because that might be something you want to get fixed.
Sure.
An electrical fire breaks out. But so I was kind of like, I was like, you know, I mean, that's kind of good. Even though it wasn't paranormal, we kind of solved one mystery. And then all of a sudden, about halfway through the night, we got a radio call from one of our guys outside, and they asked if there was anybody upstairs in the house. And we said, no, we were all downstairs at the time. And he was kind of panicked, sounded like he was panicking. And he said he was going to go upstairs and check it out because him and the other investigator outside thought that they had seen somebody in an upstairs bedroom.
Sure.
And so he went upstairs, and when he opened the bedroom door, he said that there was a female apparition of a little girl sitting on the bed where they had seen movement in the window. And he froze and was terrified and eventually got on the radio and yelled for us to come upstairs. And by the time we all got upstairs, there's about six of us in the room, I think, at the time. The apparition had disappeared. So the only one that had seen it was my investigator, Adam. And we put the EMF reader on the bed, and we were still kind of getting sporadic spikes on the EMF, which was interesting because it wasn't near any outlets or anything like that. It was right in the middle of the room, yet it was detecting, you know, electromagnetic energy.
Mm-hmm.
And we kind of felt drawn to the closet. I couldn't explain it. We all just kind of were staring at this closet door that was shut. And one of the investigators opened it up. And as soon as he opened it up, all six of us in the room immediately felt like this ice cold. And I policed up in the Arctic for 5 years. It was even colder than that. So colder than like minus 60 degrees Celsius. Go right through us. Like it felt like it went like right through our chest, and it kind of took your breath away. And then the coldness just kind of dissipated. And we had a reverend on our team at the time. So he just kind of said like a non-denominational prayer type thing. And then the room kind of felt like it was at peace. So the EMF reader stopped buzzing. And like I said, the cold spot had dissipated. And that's all the activity that kind of happened at that house. We were able to solve the photograph issue later on with the faces in the photograph. So what it was because it was this old 18th century home or 19th century home with those nice wooden door frames with the high gloss on it.
Mm-hmm.
Whenever they would take pictures, it was basically visual pareidolia, which is when your mind tries to look for a face. So same as if you look up at the clouds long enough, you'll eventually, you know, see Mickey Mouse up in the clouds, or you'll see a knight in shining armor, or whatever your mind wants to kind of lead you to believe.
Mm-hmm.
That's what was happening with the photographs. But we still could not explain Adam seeing the apparition or the penny. So there was no doubt in my mind that that house was haunted. And that was my first... I would say that was my first experience with the paranormal. And that was just before I had joined the police force, probably about 2 years before.
So, I mean, after having that experience, I mean, did you accept it right away that this was a paranormal experience? Were you trying to, obviously you did do some research to try and figure out what's, you know, what is logical here? What is just our bodies and brains doing their thing? But was it difficult to accept that, you know, there, you just had an experience?
I think for some of the investigators, it was. For me, I've always been a believer. I'm definitely a lot more critical now, you know, fast forwarding. I've been doing the, you know, paranormal research investigation now for 25 years.
Sure.
So the longer and the older I get, I find the more like critical I get, especially after being in the police force. But at the time, those two things sat okay with me.
Mm-hmm.
I had read other literature that pennies in particular show up at certain haunted houses, but other people have reported other coins materializing as well. We had a poltergeist case here in Nova Scotia back in the 1800s that the Society for Psychical Research, the American Society for Psychical Research, had investigated in Windsor, Nova Scotia, and they had foreign coins like coming from Europe that were materializing over there. So that part wasn't uncommon. And then of course, you know, the investigator seeing the apparition as well. I felt there was, you know, something paranormal happening for sure. Now apparitions, there's different theories on it. So, you know, we know that high excessive amounts of electromagnetic energy can cause people to see apparitions. And in this house did have some of that, you know, down by the stairwell. So mm-hmm. that could have been possibly why the homeowners were seeing this apparition walk up and down those stairs. there's also been other cases as well. One as recent as 2005, where carbon monoxide has been linked to people seeing apparitions. There was a lady getting a shower, and this apparition had appeared. And of course, she freaked out because she's in the shower and this apparition appears in the shower with her. So she calls a paranormal investigative team. And when they conducted their investigation, they found out she had just had a brand new hot water tank installed, and it was installed improperly. So it was giving off excessive amounts of carbon monoxide, which was causing her to hallucinate. So there's certainly, you know, normal, rational, scientific explanations on why people see ghosts. But then there's also that other percent where you just can't explain this yet. Anyways, I think one day, you know, we'll possibly be able to kind of clean the field up a little bit and have stronger explanations for things. But, you know, right now, just with the technology that's available and all the experiences that are reported by people, because that's what we do as parapsychologists, we study, and that's why parapsychology is actually considered a social science, is because we study the human experience. That's what's being reported to us as humans' experience with these apparitions. So, I think where I was a believer and those two things were not out of the ordinary for the paranormal, I think I was okay with those.
What's interesting is when our minds do these things, when the wiring's not right, when there's carbon monoxide and things of that nature, and we start to hallucinate or see things. The carbon monoxide, I understand more. The wiring, to me, is still like always kind of a weirder, more tricky one to understand. Give me a better understanding of the EMF and how that affects our brain, and how the human brain ends up going to creating these images in front of us, these hallucinations, you know, without the aid of, you know, gases or a substance or anything like that.
Well, the biggest study that we're aware of was done by Dr. Michael Persinger, who's deceased now, unfortunately. But he was a neuroscientist at Laurentian University in Ontario. And he created what's called the God helmet. So he took a snowmobile helmet and he had placed electrodes in it. And he found research participants to participate in a study. And he had a belief that people are experiencing the paranormal, but that he believed it was being caused by something in the environment. So he didn't doubt people's experiences, but he thought that there was some sort of like scientific explanation for it. So he created the God helmet, and what he would do is get participants to put this helmet on, and he would slowly increase the magnetic field through the electrodes in the helmet. And once it got to a certain point, people started reporting apparitions. They would see apparitions that they didn't know. Some people would report apparitions of deceased loved ones. And then other people would even report religious figures, such as the Virgin Mary and Jesus Christ. And he was able to kind of keep replicating those results. And after he passed away, actually, the research assistants that he had owned the patent to the God helmet. They have kind of a homemade version of it you can buy. It's quite expensive. It's about $650, $700 US. I believe it's called the Shira helmet. They renamed it, but you can actually purchase it yourself, and people can do their own kind of experiments with it. But we know from that you know, people can I don't want to say hallucinate, but they can experience, you know, an apparition from that increase. And my partner, Daryl Walsh, he actually had a case where somebody was reporting a haunting in a house, but it was only in the bedroom. And when he went to investigate, he found out that there was this old alarm clock next to the bed. And it was giving off high, excessive amounts of electromagnetic radiation. So the EMF reader was just through the roof on this thing. Mm-hmm. And he had made that suggestion to the homeowners to replace that clock or unplug that clock and just kind of see and make note of any sort of activity that happens in the house. And once that clock was removed from the room, the people stopped experiencing seeing an apparition late at night while they were sleeping. And they never, ever did have any other activity happen. So that's kind of where that part comes from. Now, the geomagnetic activity from the Earth as well has also been linked to UFO sightings. You know, I know when I used to investigate UFO sightings, sometimes they would occur near fault lines or wherever there's like geo activity occurring, and people would report those types of UFOs as like balls of light in the sky. So we know that, you know, certain things cause us to experience things differently. There's other things as well besides like carbon monoxide and radiation. There was one of my other mentors, Lloyd Auerbach, who's a parapsychologist in California, had this really amazing case. I always refer to it on a podcast, but it was almost like the perfect scientifically designed haunted house. But this architect had kind of built this house, and he kind of did a few different things. He was experimenting with his architecture, I guess. And this couple had signed a lease and moved into this house, but they started to experience all kinds of what they thought was paranormal activity. They were reporting balls of light floating in the air, furniture in the walls spontaneously catching fire, one room that was freezing cold compared to the rest of the house, another room where they would walk in and they'd feel sick to their stomach. And when Lloyd and his parapsychologist assistant went and investigated, they found a whole bunch of issues with the house. So one of the issues was that the new subdivision was built on a landfill. So the balls of light that they were experiencing was actually a lot of static electricity mixed with methane gas that was coming up through the ground. Mm-hmm. And that's what was causing the sparks and the fires to break out. The room that was ice cold, when they called in a surveyor, found out that there was running water underneath the house, which has been associated to people experiencing haunting activity. But the running water was the reason why the room temperature was very different than the rest of the house. Mm-hmm. The room that they reported where they would walk into and not feel very well, there was a lot of things that were uneven in that room. The flooring was uneven. The design of the room was uneven. So it was messing with their equilibrium in their head, the fluid in the brain, which was, you know, same as if you got onto a circus ride. I can't do those anymore without gravel at this age. But when you get on those types of rides, because it's uneven terrain, the fluid in your in between your ears kind of move, and it caused you to feel nauseous and feel off. So they were able to get them out of the lease. The landlord didn't want to let them out of the lease because they had just signed it, but they basically threatened them to go to the city to report all these kind of non-code violations they found with the house. And yeah. The owner decided to let them out of the house. So there's a multitude of things that can, you know, cause people to experience hauntings. And that's what a true paranormal investigator looks for. You come into these cases with that mind, like, okay, what is occurring in this location that is causing this experience? And you try and rule that out first before jumping to, you know, just, oh, this house is haunted or this location is haunted.
Let me ask you this. When we have these sort of things going on and the environment is like this, there's obviously some elements that can be easily explained. Water running underneath the house, that explains the cold spots. And some of it you can easily connect the dots. Some of it, though, I do wonder, does having some of these things open up a portal ever? Or maybe not a portal, but something. Our senses, maybe more is the correct word, to experience things that are indeed paranormal that we otherwise wouldn't experience without the aid of some of these outside factors.
Well, I would say, yes, certain conditions, I think, yeah, would make people more susceptible to seeing stuff. I know, for example, when your arousability is low, so when you're tired or you're just, you know, just about ready to fall asleep. Mm-hmm. Our minds are pretty relaxed, and there's been lots of parapsychological studies that have been done which show people tend to score higher on results with extrasensory perception and psychic abilities when their mind is at a relaxed state. So I definitely think that you have to look at each location separately and kind of see what's the area. The other thing as well that's interesting that we you're starting to see a lot of research pop up on is infrasound. So sound that we cannot physically hear as humans, but exists in the environment. And we know that certain infrasounds have also caused people to feel eerie, feel like they're being watched, possibly even see something like a shadow out of the corner of their eye. And there is technology that exists to monitor for infrasound. We purchased one, but we haven't had time to play around with it. But I know there was one case where it detected the elevator from the building next to the house. There was like an apartment building next to this house that was experiencing some paranormal activity. And they were able to pick up infrasound coming from the apartment building because the elevator was really old and it wasn't in its best operating condition. And it was causing an excessive amount of infrasound, which could have possibly contributed to the haunting. You know, some things in the paranormal, that's why it's the paranormal. You simply can't explain, you know, so they couldn't confirm 100% that the infrasound was causing that issue, but it certainly raised a red flag. You know, another example of things that we can't prove are electronic voice phenomena, for example, because there's four different theories to what an EVP actually is. One theory is that it's audio pareidolia. So similar to visual pareidolia, like I explained earlier, is that when you hear something that's nonsensical, the brain, it's designed to try and make sense of it. So I always find if someone gets you to listen to an EVP and they tell you what they think it says, now that's all you can hear. But I find more times than not when somebody's like, can you listen to this EVP and tell me what you hear? A lot of times, unless it's extremely clear, there are some very clear EVPs. A lot of times you're like, yeah, I hear something. I hear that voice, but I cannot tell what it's saying. And it's not until a person tells you what it is, then all of a sudden that's all you can hear. The other theory is obviously the one that we all want, is that it's a discarnate entity trying to communicate with us through a recording device. The other one, which I have actually experienced on a case, was what they call crossover communication. There was a couple, two guys talking back and forth on Facebook Messenger, but they were using the audio instead of typing out. And all of a sudden, when one guy was responding to his friend, this other voice popped up on the recording. And so they had come across our website and sent us the recordings and just asked us if we could look into see what this is. And they thought it was kind of strange. And it was not your typical EVP. Your typical EVP is quiet. It's almost like a whisper. This one was like very loud, very prominent. And I had a friend that was had just gotten out of tech crimes with the RCMP. And they analyze all the digital evidence for their, you know, the police. It could be drug trafficking, cell phone information. It could be fraud investigation through computers. So I sent him the audio clip and I asked him if you could analyze it for me. So he was able to isolate both voices and run it through some electronic software, engineering software. And the best guess that he could come up with was that somehow another communication through Facebook had been recorded on these guys' conversation. And it kind of made sense, that explanation, just because, like I said, it didn't sound like your typical EVP. It was just too prominent, but it was some sort of electronic interference that had occurred, which is another theory for the EVPs, is that you're picking up, you know, not so much now with portable phones, but cell phones and other things in the area might record on your recording device. And then the last theory with EVPs, which I also know somebody that personally had this happen to them, is Michelle DeRoche. She runs the Outer Realm podcast out of Toronto with Amelia Pisano. So she was on an investigation once, and her and her tech person had gone to the house to interview the homeowners to get initial interview to see whether or not they had enough information to conduct a full scale investigation. But that evening when Michelle went to her house, her daughter was at home sick with her husband. So she was really worried about her daughter. And while they were doing the interview, you know, Michelle was asking questions, collecting information from the homeowners. And then they went home and her tech guy downloaded the statement and was transcribing it for her. And while he was transcribing it, he could hear an unnatural flow of conversation occur on the recording. He could hear the Michelle ask a question. The homeowner was responding to the question, but midway through responding to the question, all of a sudden he can hear Michelle blurt out and say, I got to get home. My daughter's really sick. And it didn't interrupt the flow of conversation or anything like that, like it would, because if somebody just blurted that out while they're telling a story, you would stop speaking and probably say, geez, well, maybe you should get home to your daughter or whatever, or acknowledge it at some point. And it wasn't acknowledged. And the tech guy that was sitting next to Michelle while the interview was being done never heard her say that. So he thought that was strange. So he called her up and questioned her about it and said, you know, during the interview, I heard this. And she said, geez, she's like, I was thinking that a lot while I was at the house, but I obviously didn't say it out loud, you know, because that would be rude and whatnot. And she's trying to find the recording for me. She said it's on an old cassette tape, but I want to use it during some of my parapsychological lectures as like an example. But that's the fourth theory on EVPs, is that it's telepathy being recorded from either the investigators, the homeowners, or even somebody that's just in the general area.
Mm-hmm.
So we know that EVPs exist, kind of cycling back to the point of these four theories. We know that EVPs exist, but we don't know exactly what they are, because there's four examples that I've experienced either personally or through close friends that have all recorded an EVP, but for different reasons.
When it comes to EVPs and the, not only that, but also let's kind of expand this a little bit beyond just EVPs, because obviously some can be very compelling. Another thing that a lot of people have been using and utilizing is things like a ghost box, where it's a series of, you know, sounds that come through a radio scanning something. And sometimes it can come across as fairly logical. Sometimes it's really you just caught a DJ saying a word or a commercial that kind of makes sense. But there is sometimes a specific sound to some of those noises when they come through. What's your thoughts on that? And is that an EVP of some sort?
Yeah, and I think I know kind of where you're getting at with that. I do have a spirit box, for example, which uses AM, FM radio stations, and it cycles it through. And you can ask questions, and sometimes you get word responses. And exactly what you said, my only experience with those devices is the words that I hear, I can tell are clearly coming from the DJ at the radio station or the news anchor.
Yeah.
But I have seen... I have seen a couple of videos of some impressive ones where, it's not just a one word answer. It's like a four or five word answer and it makes complete sense. So I don't, and I do know from other things, there was a great documentary. It's quite old now. I can't even think of the name of it. It's that old, but, it was about an Italian guy that could talk to ghosts through a radio, and he had removed the receiver and transmitter from the radio, but voices were still coming out of it. So we know that, you know, spirits can use communication devices to communicate to us through it. I actually had that case I was telling you earlier where I wrote my first book, Evil in Exeter, The Haunting in Rhode Island. A spirit would, besides manipulating the TV, turning it on and off by itself and all that stuff, had spoken into the homeowner's cell phone using Siri and had left a message for her. So we know that, you know, ghosts can use electronic devices to communicate. I do think that for the most part, I find those tools a little bit too noisy. And I would, I personally stick to your tape recorders, your digital recorders for those. But I mean, I do think that they would work in the right condition. Just, I don't find them to be the best tool. I've never had much success with it. In fact, I was at the Fortress of Lewisburg in Cape Breton. I was asked to help out a local paranormal group to do a paranormal lecture out there. And I had brought one spirit box just to show people how loud they are and whatnot. But it was actually so far out and remote that there was no radio stations it could pick up. So the device itself couldn't even work anyway, because it was so remote, it had no AM FM stations to kind of tap into. So again, it depends on your location, your conditions and your environment. But I do think, you know, again, I do think that they can work in certain circumstances. Mm-hmm. The apps I'm a little bit more skeptical of. I know the same group that I helped out, they use, I think it's called AudioVox is their app, I think they use. Mm-hmm. But what it does is you basically ask questions and all of a sudden it'll just kind of like randomly like shout out words. But I don't find those ones reliable. And I'm not a software engineer, but I think if you could get somebody to go through those apps and kind of reverse engineer them, you might see that a lot of them are designed for entertainment purposes only. You know, obviously somebody's downloading a ghost app, so it could be pre-programmed with words associated to hauntings and ghosts and demons and things like that. So a little bit more skeptical of the apps. Again, I kind of prefer the old style, you know, go with your digital recorder. Mm-hmm. If you have a tape recorder that still uses cassettes, you know, use that as well. Yeah, I mean, they're all tools that are available for sure.
That wraps up the first part of our conversation with Elliot Van Dusen in part two. What was happening in Rhode Island at a home that shocked Elliot? What personally happened to Elliot and his family when they encountered a demonic entity? Has there ever been a time where Elliot felt that it may be time to walk away from the supernatural for safety? Those questions and much more in part two. To hear it, become a Gravekeeper. That's a supporter of our program. Sign up to be one at patreon.com/thegravetalks or go to thegravetalks.com and click become a Gravekeeper. There you'll get access to all of our episodes in their entirety, all commercial free. Every single one there for you to binge away on. Hundreds upon hundreds of hours of ghost stories, nonstop, back to back, commercial free. Check it out, patreon.com/thegravetalks, or search The Grave Talks on the Patreon app. Until next time, for The Grave Talks, I'm Tony Bruschi. Thanks for listening.